Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday local news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCBW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today, two counties send a warning to the state that Utah's plan for distributing medical marijuana might run afoul of federal law. Environmental groups raise an alarm over mislabeled nuclear waste shipments through the state. Some parishioners at a Catholic church protest a priest who shared anti-LGBTQ and pro-assault rifle posts on social media. And remembering former Utah First Lady Norma Matheson. All those stories and actually a few more are coming up on the show. Joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune editor Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Good morning, Jennifer.
Thanks Good morning. For being here. Thanks for the invite.
Of course. Government and politics editor Dan Harry is here in studio with us as well. And good morning, Dan.
Good morning.
And joining us on the phone, we have Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner. And good morning and welcome to you, Courtney.
Good morning.
Good morning. If you'd like to join this conversation, you can call 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also tweet your questions to us. Our handle is at KCPW. And let's begin today actually with something that I didn't just tease right now. This is a late addition to the docket of stories. Something that appears at sltrib.com this morning, a new poll in the Salt Lake City mayor's race. Dan Harry, government and politics editor with the Salt Lake Tribune, a tightening race, according to this poll.
It is indeed. And you're right, this is breaking news. This poll was just published this morning, and it was just taken this week, Monday through Wednesday, the phone calls and were going out and some online to respondents. The biggest winner in this poll is undecided, 28%. So this race could go anywhere, but the real interesting thing in the numbers we do have for candidates was that Luz Escamilla gained a lot since the last poll, which was done in June against Jim DeBacchus, the front runner. That last poll that was done by Alliance for a Better Utah showed a 17 percentage point gap between DeBacchus and Escamilla, and she has cut that to just 4 percentage points. So that's pretty good momentum right there.
And that's within the margin of error.
Within the margin of error of this poll, yeah.
And
mention, too, that Erin Mendenhall, the city councilwoman, also made some progress, not quite as dramatic as Escamilla's, but she boosted her approval rating in this poll to 13%. So she's still in it.
Okay, so 1, 2, 3 are as far as this poll goes, and it was conducted by the Salt Lake Tribune and the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Yeah. 21%, Jim DeBacchus, 17%, Luz Escamilla, 13%, Erin Mendenhall. The top two vote getters advance to the general election. To the general election in November, and
the primary is on the 13th.
11 days from now.
Yeah, it's coming right up.
All right, interesting polling numbers from the Salt Lake Tribune, and I don't know. There's two, Jennifer Napier-Pierce, editor of the Tribune. You've got two who are going to advance. Does anybody else? I mean, it's a big field. 8 candidates. That undecided pool kind of throws a wrench in the works here. We don't know what's going to happen.
Absolutely. And as our story points out, David Ibarra, who's raised a lot of money, doesn't believe it. He says he's, according to our poll, he's at 6%. But he says that his internal polls show him at number 2. And I don't know. I mean, money does talk. So it's interesting if people are sitting on the fence for him. They certainly haven't vocalized their support, at least in this poll. What I like about this poll is there's a very large sample. It's over 400 people who responded of Salt Lake City registered voters. So these are people who are likely to cast the ballot. Less than 2 weeks to go at this point. One other interesting piece in our poll is the gender breakdown. So more men are voting for DeBacchus. More women are voting for Escamilla. And maybe that is not super surprising, but just something to note as well. And I believe it was David Garbett who had a majority of female support. That's, so, again, take a look at sltrib.com. This is just breaking this morning.
Yeah. What I really think is interesting is that It shows that voters are going to be real focused on this in the next couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
That puts a lot of pressure on candidates. If they make a mistake or if they do something that wins popular or public support just in the next couple of weeks, that could make the difference. So that's kind of an exciting race. We don't often have that kind of excitement, competitive race in Utah, but this is one to watch and enjoy.
Well, and something that's kind of surprising about it is that level of undecided, given the fact that we've seen, I mean, there have been a number of debates, a lot of forums.
Billboards,
and a lot of time,
ads,
right,
yeah,
for people to make
they're
them.
Out there. And, you know, I think all of these candidates have appeared in, like, a dozen, at least, you know, sit-downs with citizens, panel discussions, and that kind of thing. They've been very accessible, which also is interesting, because a lot of times, especially when you have a strong incumbent, they will not participate and other challengers can't get traction. This is wide open. So I think the candidates feel that pressure.
And, of course, some of that coming from the fact that the incumbent is not running for re-election, Mayor Jackie Piskupski. Speaking of voters, let's turn actually now to some other news from this past week. We've got this has to do with laws passed in the legislature that significantly modified some initiatives that were passed by voters last year. And that means, of course, that we're talking about medical marijuana and Medicaid expansion, two separate topics with some maybe similar hiccups as far as implementation of those laws goes. Dan Harry, let's start with Medicaid expansion. The state of Utah had a plan. Again, it wasn't the plan that voters passed. It was a new Utah way of doing things for Medicaid, but it's not going the way that lawmakers wanted it to go. Why not?
Well, the big hiccup right now is two counties, Salt Lake and Davis, two of the largest counties in the state, are warning their county health departments not to be distribution points for cannabis.
And that's the medical marijuana one. I was talking about the Medicaid expansion.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, which is fine. I mean, this is the federal government making a different decision about Medicaid expansion.
So Medicaid, the Utah voters approved full expansion, which fits in with the Affordable Care Act and would have meant that everybody up to 138% of poverty level would be eligible for Medicaid coverage. And it would have been reimbursed by the federal government at 90%. So the Utah would be paying 10% of the total cost.
Would have been.
Yeah. And the legislature, they have always been resistant to the Affordable Care Act, and they continue to be so. But in this case, they realized that there is support for expanding Medicaid, so they did what they called a compromise. The people who pushed the initiative did not see it as a compromise. They felt like they were excluded from the process. But the end result was a system that covered people up to 100% of poverty level, and we only get a reimbursement for 70% from the federal government. What Utah had asked was that the feds grant us certain waivers to allow us to have these departures from the Affordable Care Act formula and still get reimbursed at 90%. And they have now been informed by the feds that no, that will not happen.
That waiver is not going to come. And this was sort of almost a preemptive response from the federal government. The state of Utah had not yet filed that waiver request. They were going to, I think, this week.
Mm-hmm.
Will the state of Utah still file that? Will they still proceed forward, or what's going to happen next?
It seems like they will not do that. They see no purpose in doing so. So what happens next is unclear, but under the bill that was passed, there's a fallback position which would kick in next January, which would return to what the initiative essentially tried to do. And whether legislators will let that happen or try to preemptively amend the law, we'll have to see.
Proponents of the ballot initiative, this is Proposition 3, they had warned that this would happen, that the waiver request wasn't going to be granted by the federal government. Now that those warnings have come true, how are proponents responding? I mean, they're obviously advocating for this full expansion fallback position, I imagine.
Absolutely. They have from the beginning. They thought the plan that the legislature passed would not win federal approval and is more costly, covering fewer people. So, yeah, they very much want to see that full expansion implemented.
There's a quote in this article, I think it was from Ben Wood, about – this comes from Senator Alan Christensen, who was the sponsor of the bill that modified and changed the way that the state of Utah was going to address Medicaid. He says essentially – I mean, if this is how it plays out, he says they were right, we were wrong, meaning they being the proponents of full Medicaid expansion who got this proposition passed, which – I just have to say, is kind of something you don't hear elected officials saying very
exactly.
Often.
Savor that comment, because legislators do not utter those words very often.
Could you get him on tape so you could play it back a couple times? That might be fun.
Jennifer, this is about people in healthcare and changes to a ballot initiative and a lot more. What do you think? Do you think that the full Medicaid expansion that is the backstop to Senator Christensen's bill is going to happen?
I think unless legislators intervene. Now, the reason why the feds said that they didn't approve this waiver is because of a case that's working its way through the federal courts.
Right.
I think it's in the Fifth District. That's challenging the Affordable Care Act. And they thought, you know, by granting a waiver that it could jeopardize or weaken their case before this court. You know, at the end of the day, though, this sort of repeal and replace didn't work. Right. You know, it just did not work. And so I can't imagine that legislators would try again. You know, never say never. But yeah. If they don't intervene, Prop 3 will go into effect in January. And that's what should have happened from the outset. And again, I mean, I think that the legislators had concerns about money, and they wanted to make sure that the state could afford this kind of implementation. What they should have done is let it go forward, and then if it was a problem, then come back and remedy and fix it. So I don't know. They had this false confidence in the federal waiver all along, and they were wrong, as Senator Christensen said.
Dan, Jennifer mentioned this court case. I mean, Utah is a party to the lawsuit that's trying to get the Affordable Care Act overturned right now. And there was I think it was at the end of last year, in Texas, a judge said, yeah, you can proceed with this, or we toss out all of the Affordable Care Act, this one judge that's being appealed. Could lawmakers at the Utah state level, I mean, here in Utah, maybe not do the full Medicaid expansion as envisioned under Prop 3 in the hope that lawsuit is successful? Or I guess it's hard to know what's going to happen next, right?
Yeah, it is hard to know. And, you know, the administration has changed positions on this. They were in the position of defending the Affordable Care Act. And I think it was about 6 weeks ago that the administration decided, no, they were not going to defend the existing law. Mm. And there may be some rethinking of that. I've been hearing reporting that President Trump realizes that health care is going to be a huge issue in the 2020 election. A lot of people say that Republicans' attempts to throw out the Affordable Care Act was largely responsible for Democrats taking control of the House last year. And so we'll see. We have a presidential election year coming up that could change the equation quite a bit.
33 states have expanded full Medicaid expansion or taken full Medicaid expansion. There was a rally yesterday at the Capitol asking lawmakers to do just that, and I guess we'll see what happens. I want to, you know, I tease the fact that it's not just the state's Medicaid plan that has hit a snag here in Utah. It turns out that Utah's scheme to make medical marijuana available to some patients in the state has had some problems as well, and this has to do with a proposition. Dan Harry, this is because of the way that the state has been planning to distribute medical cannabis, as you mentioned a little bit earlier. Again, this is a retooled version of another voter-approved initiative. What's wrong with the way that Utah wants to distribute medical cannabis?
Well, so the state wants the counties to be a distribution point, the county health departments to be a distribution point for those in rural Utah, those that are not in central locations where these approved pharmacies will be located. And so they thought, well, we've got this existing network of county health departments. Let's use those as pickup points, and we'll, you know, courier the cannabis to those places, and then patients won't have to travel long distances to try to get this medication.
Just quickly, elsewhere, it will be privately run pharmacies that are essentially...
Yeah, but there's only a limited number approved, yeah. You know, and they'll be tightly regulated.
Okay.
But a couple of the large counties, Salt Lake and Davis, said, there's a federal law against cannabis. We don't want to put our people at risk, make them essentially drug dealers. And, we don't want to participate in this. And so the legislature now is behind the scenes trying to correct this, saying that they've got some solutions, but they won't talk about what those specific solutions are. And as Jennifer said, this is the second case that's come up just recently where we've seen that the legislature's supposed fix of flawed initiatives has sort of backfired, and it kind of calls into question what we hear from the legislature, which is we're the best body to pass laws because we can deliberate, we have resources to do a lot of research, and so we can produce the most effective, workable laws. And these two issues have really called that into question.
There's also the state of Utah says that they have assurances. This isn't about the drug dealing part of this, but one of the concerns also was that the state health department could lose grant money if they were to be involved in the distribution of medical marijuana, or these county, I guess, health departments would. Mm-hmm. The state has a letter assuring them that that wouldn't be the case.
The state has a letter saying that, but as one of the initiative organizers pointed out, that is non-binding. A letter is not a binding contract that the state could use to have assurance that that's true.
Well, and the state did have, just going back to the previous story, they had assurances that they would get a waiver from the federal government as well. Yeah. Jennifer Napier-Pierce, obviously modifications to a citizen initiative, but then trying to roll out medical marijuana in Utah, proving to be problematic under this state's Utah plan.
The state wants control. I don't think it's too far of an exaggeration to call legislators control freaks. You know, I do think that they want to regulate, which is funny because philosophically most of them would say that they're conservative, but they're very wary of the way that other states have done this through private dispensaries. That's fine, I guess, but it does say something about they didn't do all their homework on this one, you know? I mean, I do think that there's a reason that other states have gone down a different route and that it seems to have worked. These private dispensaries don't have the liabilities that the state would have to incur. There's a level of risk. And I do think that these concerns that have been voiced by Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill and Troy Rawlings, they both have voiced these concerns before. This was part of the debate, and here we are. So yeah. I think the long and short of it is, though, as Dan mentioned, there are limited numbers of private dispensaries. So the private dispensaries are integrated into this, but there are only seven for the entire state of Utah. And so when you talk about availability, particularly for rural consumers whose doctors have said you could benefit from medical cannabis, are they going to be able to get it? And that's a real question mark, I think.
Why not go the route that's already been tested with other states? I mean, why did Utah feel the need to, or why were lawmakers so concerned with having a greater number of those private pharmacies and going the route that other states have gone? Does anybody want to try and answer
well,
that?
Well, I will say, don't forget that one of the key elements leading up to this was the LDS Church coming out and opposing strongly the initiative that was out there, but at the same time realizing that there was a great deal of popular momentum behind this, that they said the church is in support of medical marijuana, but we need it more closely regulated. And they were very fearful of just, marijuana kind of running amok through the state and sort of a reefer madness starting here. And so they were a huge part of this equation.
Jennifer Napier-Pierce, editor of the Salt Lake Tribune, I'll give you the final word on this as a representative of your editorial board before we head to a break on the show.
Yeah, like I said, it's a matter of control. And I do think that they don't want to give over to the private sector something that they see as very dangerous for society. But their plan isn't going to work.
All right, again, that's Salt Lake Tribune editor Jennifer Napier-Pierce. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCBW and Utah Public Radio. We're going to take a quick break. Back in a minute.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCBW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio. I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune editor Jennifer Napier-Pierce, government and politics editor Dan Harry, and reporter Courtney Tanner. You can join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255 or tweet your questions to @KCPW. Let's turn now to the death of a prominent Utahn, a former First Lady of the state, Norma Matheson. And Jennifer Napier-Pierce, Salt Lake Tribune editor, she was the wife of former Utah Governor Scott Matheson, who preceded her in death by a few decades. And she's being remembered as more than Utah's First Lady. How is Norma Matheson being remembered?
We had a lovely obituary that was written by our columnist, Robert Gerke. Many people expressed how she was the godmother of Democrats in the state of Utah. And the adjectives say it all. Empathetic, she was full of grace, common sense, energetic, intelligent, publicly minded. She was sort of lauded as the hub of a very publicly involved family. Like you mentioned, her husband Scott was the governor for two terms. A son now serves on the 10th Circuit Court. Another son served seven terms, Jim Matheson, in Congress. Her husband died in 1990.
Right.
And she has remained since then very active in community service, serving on a ton of boards. She's served as a major proponent of the Count My Vote initiative.
Right.
She also really was involved in education and health. And so I think she was a community leader in her own right. And a lot of people attribute her family success to her her pushing them, supporting those public service values through her whole family.
And again, a sort of dynasty, as Jennifer's pointing to, with a family. But then in later years, I just have to turn to that idea of changing election law in Utah and Count My Vote and how big of a deal that was. Dan Harry?
It was a huge thing. And, we are starting to see the results of that in some of the members of Congress that we elect and I think in some more independence of legislators in some areas of the state. And that's been a huge change, and it will be something that affects politics for generations to come.
You have to wonder, I'm just circling back to a story we covered earlier. We haven't covered this story yet. We're going to turn to it. We will turn to a conversation about shipments of nuclear waste through the state, but I'm thinking about Scott Matheson, whose cancer was attributed to fallout from the Nevada test site, what he and his wife Norma would have made of that story, which we will get to later in the show. There's so much to check out on this remembrance of Norma Matheson, and you can find it at sltrib.com. I want to remind listeners that you can join this conversation. Again, 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can tweet us at KCPW with your questions and comments as well. Yeah, go ahead, Jennifer.
Just one last thing. I mean, her praise came from both sides of the aisle. I will say that a lot of Republicans admired her commitment to serving community, to serving her family. So it wasn't just godmother of Democrats. her presence, I do think, and her influence was felt and respected across the political spectrum.
And there are a lot of comments in this remembrance that Robert Kirky wrote and elsewhere in the Tribune pointing to that love, comments from the governor and comments from former governors and so on and so forth. Check it out again at sltrib.com. I want to bring Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner in on the conversation. Courtney, assuming that you're still there on the phone, thanks for hanging out for a while. Are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Glad to hear it. Let's turn to a story that you have been following this week about some protests over a Catholic priest's reassignment to a parish in Salt Lake City. And the protests have to do with some political and social stances that he has taken. This parish, St. Ambrose, is one that already had a bit of controversy not that long ago because of the actions of another priest. What's all the fuss, Courtney? People at this Catholic parish and the school associated with it are upset. Why?
Yeah, that's right. So this community has really been riled over the past year over some issues with the priest there. So like you said, it includes St. Ambrose Church as well as the Cosgrove Memorial Catholic School. And so the priest that they had previously was charged last fall with patronizing a prostitute. He has since pleaded no contest, but the Catholic diocese has moved him to a different school, which has left a vacancy in this Salt Lake City parish. And that vacancy was filled by Father Eric, and some of the congregants at this Catholic church are pretty upset with Father Eric because of some posts that he's made on social media. Some of them are anti-LGBT, some of them mock women, a lot of them are pretty pro-assault rifle and make jokes about guns, and there's this kind of frustration that this guy is going to be the priest over this parish.
And those are the cause for the uproar at St. Ambrose Parish. I should say that the story is kind of near and dear to me because as a kid, I attended this school and this parish as well. I understand that you spoke to one person who is pulling her kids out of that school?
That's right. So I talked to a woman named Claire Donnelly. She has three kids who have attended the school all since they were 4 years old. And she's kind of decided that her family just can't deal with this priest, can't deal with this decision to assign him to this parish, that it's just kind of too much for her family. They need to take a stand, she said, against the bigotry and the intolerance that she believes that this priest kind of represents.
There's also a petition to try and get the Catholic diocese to prevent this reassignment of this priest to this parish.
That's right. So more than 150 parents have signed this petition to kind of block this assignment. They've also sat down with Bishop Oscar Salas, who kind of oversees Utah Catholics, and he has said, you know, I'm not going to change my mind, try to move forward with this. And so there's kind of a lot of frustration around this, but not a lot of movement yet.
Okay, so that's the response from the diocese is we're going ahead with this.
That's right. Bishop Salas said, you know, Father Eric has faults, you know, everyone has weaknesses and failings, but he still has, you know, the zeal for priestly ministry.
You know what, Jennifer Napier-Pierce, Salt Lake Tribune editor, maybe I'll bring you in on this. This is this kind of represents some of the same divides that we see in our society. Those divides exist in religious communities as well sometimes, and I could imagine that some, not necessarily all, but some conservative Catholics would be okay with this priest posting anti-LGBTQ, pro-gun, anti-women posts, and so on. Then at the same time, you have a Catholic pope who is considered a voice of progressives to a certain extent. Parents at this parish, though, they don't like it. I don't know. Any thoughts on this story, Jennifer, in general?
Let me just be clear. There were so many social media posts we could not publish in our family-friendly publication. These are not like, I mean, these are truly offensive posts. And I understand the outrage of these parents who were paying to send their kids to what they think is a respectable Catholic school. It is a stain on that community. It's really too bad. I think it's a real misstep for Bishop Solis to sort of have this indifference. Well, you know, we all have our opinions. Well, guess what? When you publish those opinions, you should be scrutinized. And I do think that the parents are rightly frustrated on this one.
In a public school,
the public school, this would not happen. I mean, this person would already be escorted out.
Courtney, is there anything, I mean, what's next in the story? And are we missing any part of it? We just now wait and see what happens?
Yeah, so Father Eric has taken his post as of yesterday, and I think parents are kind of anxious to see, you know, what he says over the pulpit, if the bishop is willing to change his mind and change this assignment. So, yeah, kind of a wait and see at this point.
Okay.
I think in Courtney's story, he leads a weekly mass. Is that right? So I don't know the degree to which he has day-to-day interactions with the students, but that is a public place where he can talk about whatever he wants, right?
Yeah.
That's right. So he'll be in charge of, you know, like a weekly mass for the students, but also, you know, communions. And just, you know, he's technically the leader of this school now.
Mm-hmm. The school does have a principal as well. I know that she, has had some statements of concern in the article. You can check that out at sltrib.com. Courtney, I want to turn from this story about a religious school to a story about religion in public schools. And this is a newly passed law in South Dakota which requires schools to have the phrase "In God We Trust" displayed in all public schools. That stirred some controversy at the national level. You, though, wrote that Utah has had that requirement for decades, maybe unbeknownst to some of us. Tell us about that. How long has the phrase "In God We Trust" had to be displayed in Utah schools?
Yeah, Utah schools have had that on the books for a bit more than 17 years now.
And at the time that law was passed here in the state of Utah, this is a law that was passed in 2002, there was debate over whether this phrase belonged in public schools. What did the debate look like at that time?
Sure. So I should say in South Dakota, there's a lot of debate over this.
Right.
There's uproar, really. In Utah, you know, there was a little bit of tension, but not quite on the same level. You know, some people said that this law was silly. Some people question whether it was kind of an LDS church mandate. And so it was playing out what's happening in South Dakota, but on kind of a quieter level here in Utah 17 years ago.
Was the law in Utah ever, you would imagine, there has been talk, for example, in South Dakota that there are court challenges that might come out of this. Was it ever challenged in the courts here in Utah?
So the ACLU of Utah was kind of the big group to come out against this when it was passed in 2002, and they said that they weren't going to challenge the law because previous courts have kind of had similar rulings that said that the phrase "In God We Trust," which is the national motto, has kind of lost its religious significance. And so the ACLU of Utah said, you know, we're not going to challenge this unless we see another state challenge it and be successful in that and set kind of a precedent.
Hmm. Jennifer Napier-Pierce, again, editor of the Salt Lake Tribune. It's kind of a First Amendment question here. You've got the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Law respecting the establishment of religion. What's your take on this 17-year-old Utah law and the phrase "In God We Trust" being in public schools?
It's supposed to be, according to Courtney's story, it's supposed to be displayed prominently in schools. Like, I have to say, like, I guess I've just been immune. I've been in so many schools in this state, and I've never really noticed that it was there. So maybe it isn't that big of a deal in Utah. I don't know. I've never felt like school was pushing religion down people's throats. But, you know, I can see why the ACLU here has just been a little bit hands-off on it.
Hmm. Courtney, how is it sort of verified that a school has this phrase displayed prominently inside of its building?
Sure. So I spoke to the Utah Board of Education, and there is really no way to say what's prominent and what's not according to the law. It doesn't really specify it. So in South Dakota, it says, you know, this phrase has to be 12 by 12 inches. In Utah, there's nothing quite that specific. So the Utah Board of Education spokesman said, you know, what equals prominence is kind of up to discretion. And he kind of joked that you could get away with the requirement by gluing a penny to the wall because U.S. currency has that phrase on it. The way that the Utah Board of Education kind of checks this is pretty lenient, honestly. They have schools fill out this checklist every year to make sure that they're doing things such as saying the Pledge of Allegiance every morning, and there's a little box that you check if you have this phrase up on your wall. And they don't really go in and verify that. They kind of just leave it up to the school to say that they're doing it and they trust that, they could audit it if they want to. To my knowledge, there has never been an audit on that.
Okay. Anything missing from the story? I mean, will the fact that we're having the conversation nationally lead to a renewed discussion in Utah about it, and the potential for this is all hypothetical. I'm putting words in your mouth, but what are we missing, Courtney?
Yeah, I'd be curious to see if it kind of restarts that conversation here. But there haven't been any big complaints in Utah since this passed. You know, in 2002, I talked to Governor Mike Leavitt, who was governor at the time and signed the bill, and he said, you know, he thought this was best for the state. And yeah, we'll see. I guess what happens next.
Dan Harry, do you, government and politics editor with the Salt Lake Tribune, any comments on this story?
I have no comment.
No comment whatsoever. I like it. All right. Well, that's Courtney Tanner, and thank you very much again for your reporting on this, Courtney. We are going to head to another quick break in the show, and when we come back, we will turn to some additional stories from this past week's news. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune editor, Governor.
I like it.
Your name is Governor. Governor Napier Pierce. Jennifer Napier Pierce, also Salt Lake Tribune, government and politics editor Dan Harry. And joining us on the phone, we have Courtney Tanner, who is a reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. And Courtney, I actually want to turn to you with a story having to do with charter schools and the way that the state is evaluating charter schools, I believe, is the gist of this story. We had a brief conversation about it just here in that last break. But what's the latest on charter school evaluation in the state of Utah, Courtney?
Yeah, so yesterday, the Utah State Board of Education had a meeting, and they decided to form a task force that would kind of look into charter schools and how they're financially accountable and how they spend taxpayer money. And this is kind of an interesting move because there's already a Utah State Charter School Board that's supposed to be doing this, but with their vote to create this task force, the State Board of Education is kind of questioning whether the Charter School Board is actually providing that oversight that it's supposed to be providing.
Courtney, this is Dan. Can I ask whether this was kind of sparked by the closure of the one charter school that we've had read so much about recently?
Yeah, definitely was sparked by that. So American International School of Utah in Murray is what Dan's talking about. And there has been this very particularly messy and chaotic process to shut down this school. It's $400,000 in debt with special education funds that it allegedly misspent. It also has millions of dollars that it owes to other creditors. And the State Board of Education, as Dan mentioned, kind of passed this task force because it's frustrated that the State Charter School Board separately didn't step in with this charter before all this debt, before it had to kind of forcibly close it.
And wasn't John Dougal, the state auditor, appointed to lead that school for a time? I don't know if did he resign already?
Yeah, so this has been just chaos. I don't know any other way to put it, but yes, so the charter school board voted to remove the leader of the charter school, and they instated state auditor John Dougal to do that, and John Dougal was in that position for about 3 days before he stepped down. Then the entire board of the charter school stepped down, and then they got a new board, and now that entire board has stepped down. So it is just this messy process where everyone is just abandoning ship.
It really does sound like chaos, but the school itself, AISU, is shutting down on in a couple of weeks' time. And did it have multiple campuses, or was it just one location? Is that right?
So they had the one campus in Murray, and it should be noted a lot of people are having this kind of conspiracy, I guess, that this building that it's in is kind of, a bad luck place, I guess. It's in the old Fun Dome, and nothing has really stayed in that building for very long.
The Fun Dome was there for quite a while.
After the 49th Street Galleria?
49th Street Galleria.
Yeah. All right.
There's been a church there. Yeah.
Okay. Well, this is an interesting story that you should definitely check out at sltrib.com, and thanks again, Courtney, for your reporting on this. I want to turn now to a final story before we head to our underplayed stories of the week. And this is a story that Dan Harry was published in the Tribune. This is environmental groups raising an alarm over nuclear waste shipments, shipments that passed through the state of Utah, and it has to do with information received by the governor of neighboring Nevada from the Department of Energy. What's the story here, Dan?
Well, the story is that it, something like 30 shipments of waste have gone from Tennessee to Nevada, and apparently they were mislabeled. They were mislabeled as low-level radioactive waste, and apparently they were much more radioactive than that. And there were are questions about how dangerous this cargo is. But the governor of Nevada, I guess, caught wind of this, and so he pressed the Department of Energy for information and found, I believe, 32 shipments over the last several years. And so the supposition is that those, all of those or most of those went through Utah to get to Nevada. Remember Utah Gateway to Nevada is the old
great song.
Saying. But so the local environmental groups raised this issue with the governor because the governors of Nevada and New Mexico have been up in arms over this, and we haven't heard a peep from the Utah the Herbert administration, and so they sent this letter asking him to join the other governors in raising objections and questions about this, and that letter, which was sent on July 22nd, and we wrote this story earlier in the week, we contacted the governor's office and asked what his response was, and the response was, well, he hasn't reviewed it yet. He hadn't received the letter, but then the groups told us that they had hand-delivered it to his counsel days earlier. So, you know, in the past, this issue of nuclear waste has been such a huge and polarizing one for the state of Utah. It's kind of surprising that we just kind of this is met with silence from the governor.
Can I ask just how, when we say shipped through the state of Utah to Nevada, and I guess to the Nevada National Security Site, it used to be the Nevada Test Site, and is that a storage facility, by the way? There's two questions here. But first, how is it getting through the state of Utah? Is it on trucks? Is it on trains?
I believe it's trucks, yes, and highways. And that's the issue that was raised by the environmental groups was this is going through on highways. And could potentially, because of accidents or other things, endanger motorists, could endanger neighborhoods near the highways. And that they all, one of the questions they raised was, were Utah's first responders warned about this so they could be prepared to respond quickly if something, if, you know, if an accident did happen? And again, there was no answer from the governor's office about whether that occurred or not.
Jennifer Napier-Pierce, you know, first, I mean, there's a whole slew of things to talk about. One is Department of Energy sending shipments of nuclear waste that are labeled one thing but are actually another thing. And then the fact that the states don't know, silence from the governor's office. Where do you want to start?
Gosh, there's so much. And I do think it's kind of a strange turn of events that people are not outraged, particularly the local officials. I mean, if a spill happens in your part of town, you are going to have to deal with it. And I wonder if local responders and local officials understand the magnitude of that responsibility. The governor's silence, I think, is puzzling. Like, I can't figure out why he wouldn't put up some strong objections to this, and it does resurrect fear, all those fears about transportation and nuclear waste storage that, you know, from a couple of decades ago and even more recently. I want to dovetail this with a story that I believe it was Taylor Stevens wrote about this week, Dan, about cities interested in buying nuclear power from a small reactor up in Idaho Falls, and it is clearing hurdles from federal regulators. And so, again, all of these concerns surrounding nuclear waste, and a lot of Utah cities are interested in these small reactors, and could this be a path to them? Opponents say, look, we have a waste issue we haven't resolved. And secondly, alternative renewables are cheaper to develop. So why wouldn't cities go that route? There's a lot of discussion that needs to occur here. And I do think that the governor could raise the profile and start these conversations that are really important.
Dan, what does the letter, what are the environmentalists asking the governor to do?
They're asking him to join with the governors of New Mexico and Nevada in objecting to this and asking more questions about it and getting to the bottom of why this waste was sent and why it was mislabeled. And they're also asking whether the first responders here were warned of this and prepared to react quickly if there was an accident.
Okay. Really interesting, if not troubling, story. You can check it out at sltrib.com. And you know what? Let's turn to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week, where we highlight stories that maybe we just didn't cover on the show today or that otherwise amused, bemused, or informed us. And I'll stick with you, Dan Harry, Salt Lake Tribune government and politics editor. What's your pick for underplayed story?
Well, my pick is that we've seen continuing problems with the new transition to homeless resource centers from the emergency shelter downtown. And the latest real problem that was raised was that they are behind in payments to contractors by $12 million. And, a letter came out from Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox, who's kind of leading this effort, who warned that the whole project is at risk of losing its credibility if it can't pay its bills on time. And they're having to borrow money now from Salt Lake County to be able to pay their contractors. If you don't pay your contractors, subcontractors start not showing up to work. And this project, which has been delayed now several times, could be pushed back even further.
Who is the they in the they're borrowing money from Salt Lake County?
Well, the they is this nonprofit called Shelter the Homeless, which has a bunch of government officials on its board. And so it's kind of this hybrid between private and public. And
they own buildings?
They will own all of these new resource centers, and they own the building that the Road Home Shelter is in now.
Meaning the nonprofit that they operate owns these particular buildings. One of them is open, the Geraldine E. King Women's Resource Center. Two more are not open.
It's not open yet.
Not open.
It's been built. They had an opening ceremony for it. But,
yeah.
Okay. It's a story to follow. Definitely for a great pick for underplayed story. Thanks, Dan, for covering that. I'm going to turn to the phone now. And Courtney Tanner, do you have a pick for underplayed story of the week prepared?
Yeah, I want to point to a story that Jessica Miller did about the Utah County attorney pushing towards the death penalty in a case where a man killed two teens and basically dumped their bodies down a mine. And, I mean, it's quite a gruesome story, but I think that the interesting thing here is that Jessica kind of looked at the history of the death penalty in Utah, and the last time that it was successful, like in a conviction, was 1984, and that man is still alive, so he's still on death row, and it's just kind of a interesting history there.
An interesting history of the death penalty in Utah from Jessica Miller. That's Courtney Tanner's pick for underplayed story of the week. Thank you for that. And Jennifer Napier-Pierce, Salt Lake Tribune editor, what's your choice?
Gosh, you guys chose both of my underplayed stories. I guess I'll go with one. Peyton Harkins reported on the mayor of Orem, who is now under investigation after a city employee discovered irregularities. That's a nice word, that he used to make unauthorized withdrawals from the city retirement account. I would just say this is the beauty of the Tribune. We're looking at these kinds of stories. Sometimes it's the ugly underbelly of civic engagement, but I think these are important issues for taxpayers to know. And so people in Orem, are sort of scratching their head over this behavior.
Interesting irregularities.
Alleged behavior, I should say.
Yeah, alleged and then euphemistically described as well sometimes. That's Salt Lake Tribune editor Jennifer Napier-Pierce's pick for Underplayed Story. I'm going to go for my part. I'm not really prepared. And so what I will do is plug a couple of things. KCPW has been broadcasting mayoral debates over the past few weeks. We held one. We hosted one just last night that was at the Salt Lake City Public Library and was put on by the Sierra Club of Utah, and an interesting debate between the eight candidates running for office. And in addition, I had a conversation, speaking of homeless resource centers, I had a conversation with one of the board members of Shelter the Homeless. That's Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Biskupski on the KCPW Public Affairs show In the Hive just yesterday. You can check both of those stories out at kcpw.org. Find full coverage of everything that we've been talking about today at sltrib.com. And I just want to say thank you very much to Jennifer Napier-Pierce, Dan Harry, and Courtney Tanner, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, for joining me today on Behind the Headlines.
Of course. And can I plug one thing?
Of course.
Food truck rally and beer festival tomorrow night at the Gateway. It's free. Come on down.
Check it out. And that is where the Salt Lake Tribune is situated as well. Again, thanks to you all for being here. Behind the Headlines is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much to our operations director, Jesse Ellis, here at KCPW for his always excellent help with the program, and to the team at Utah Public Radio in Logan. And you can find podcasts of this and all of our local programs at kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Have a great weekend, and please join us again next week.